loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, we talk about the brouhaha between the tabloid National Enquirer and the world's richest man, Jeff Bezos, the founder of Amazon and the owner of the Washington Post. Next, we discuss France withdrawing its ambassador to Italy after populist Italian Deputy Prime Minister Luigi Di Maio met with yellow vest leaders in central Paris. Then we get into a new massive bill that co-sponsors Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey are calling the Green New Deal. And then we talk to the Wisconsin Farm Center about the myriad farmer bankruptcies going on in the Midwest. And finally, our regular Friday closing interview is about the worst and most misleading headlines of the week. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines. Acting U.S. Attorney General Matthew Whitaker testified today before the House Judiciary Committee, and it turned confrontational. In response to a question by Chairman Jerome Nadler, Whitaker snapped, quote, "Mr. Chairman, I see that your 5 minutes is up. I am here voluntarily. We have agreed to 5 minute rounds," unquote. Democratic and Republican senators set a deadline of today for the Trump administration to publish a report on the parties responsible for the murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. Senators today introduced a bill to punish Saudi Arabia for Khashoggi's murder. The border city of Nogales, Arizona, passed a resolution condemning the use of concertina wire, also known as razor wire, due to its lethality and proper use in military zones. The city council called on the federal government to cease its use and military tactics in their city. Mayor Arturo Garino said at the meeting that Nogales is very safe and that, quote, "We have children who live right next to it, 10 feet away from it," unquote. The United States Steel Corporation founded Gary, Indiana in 1906 and once employed more than 25,000 people there. That number is now down to 4,000. And the city and state have offered the company a package of $47 million worth of tax breaks to come back. However, the company plans to automate and has not yet publicly committed to keeping the 4,000 jobs that still remain. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the brouhaha between the National Enquirer and the world's richest man, Jeff Bezos. He's the founder of Amazon and the owner of the Washington Post. He also has a $600 million contract with the CIA and is likely to bag an even bigger contract with the Pentagon for providing Amazon cloud services. The National Enquirer, a tabloid that publishes an endless stream of photos and stories with salacious details about the lives of the rich and famous, published graphic and romantic text messages between Jeff Bezos and a woman he was having an affair with. Bezos has recently separated, but he was married at the time and still with his wife. Bezos was outraged, of course, over the publication of his text messages and hired a team of investigators to look at how the publisher, who's a friend of Donald Trump's, got a hold of the embarrassing text messages. As he revealed in his blog, Bezos, quote, "asked him to prioritize protecting my time since I have other things I prefer to work on and to proceed with whatever budget he needed to pursue the facts of the matter," unquote. Bezos made the assertion that the texts were part of a political hit job by AMI publisher David Pecker. The clear implication from Bezos was that Pecker was trying to embarrass him in retaliation for the Washington Post's relentless criticism of Trump. AMI, by all indications, was afraid of Bezos's investigation. Unlike other celebrities who they embarrassed through the publication of graphic photos and salacious stories about their lives, AMI knew that Jeff Bezos was something quite different. He's the richest man in the world, and he has immense influence and power. In what appears to be an effort to end the investigation and bring the situation to a close, they communicated by email with Bezos, who published the emails in his own blog post. AMI in the emails informed Bezos that unless he ended the investigation and made a public statement that the National Enquirer story about his texts was not politically motivated, that they were prepared to release compromising photos they had in their possession. These are graphic photos that Bezos apparently took of himself. Bezos is now presenting this as a struggle between the credible press, meaning the Washington Post that he owns, and by comparison, the non-credible press, meaning the National Enquirer. Bezos is also making the case that the American media publisher is trying to smear Bezos because of his continuing investigation into the Saudi killing of Jamal Khashoggi, who had been a columnist for the Washington Post. Bezos's critics are arguing that this is just Bezos being himself, caught in an embarrassing and compromising position as a result of his own actions. He's trying to deflect attention from his own role and present it as part of a political struggle against Donald Trump and the Saudi royal family. While the Washington Post has been pursuing the investigation of the murder of Khashoggi, prior to this, the Washington Post was a full-throated supporter of the Saudi royal family and the U.S.-Saudi relationship, despite the Saudis' vicious repression against people advocating for democracy and human rights in the kingdom and its genocidal war against the people of Yemen. You have all that straight? We're joined from New York by Ted Rall, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. Check out his work at www.rall.com. Ted, welcome.
Thank you. And I hope there won't be a test.
Seriously, right? You know, when the story first broke, it appeared to be, at first glance, pretty clear cut. Bezos was being threatened by AMI, the parent company of the National Enquirer. We know that the National Enquirer head, the owner, this pecker, is close to Donald Trump. And we know that they had this, what they called a catch and kill program at the Enquirer, where they would buy these salacious stories, these accusations against Trump, and just kill the story. But it's way more complicated than that. And I wonder if this is one of those situations where there just simply is no good guy. Pecker and AMI and the National Enquirer are bad. Bezos is certainly not an innocent in this thing. The Saudis are involved. What do you think? How should we be looking at this story?
Well, it's just a little tweak. I'd say that Bezos is not an innocent man, but he's an innocent in this thing. I mean, this is a guy whose marriage was falling apart and, fell in love with someone else and then got engaged to marry her. This is not an unusual story in that one respect. And I think that's kind of the bird's eye view of the issue. And when it comes to just that aspect, I'm highly sympathetic to Bezos. But you're absolutely right that, Bezos single-handedly destroyed brick-and-mortar bookstores, which are the corner of culture in the United States. He has slave laborers in his warehouses. He's driven down wages. He's even by the standards of American capitalism, which expects billionaires to be philanthropists, he has repeatedly said that he has very little interest in philanthropy. Pretty much the most noble thing he's done is take on the Washington Post, if that is noble at all. So it's true that this is a clash between two highly unpalatable forces. I think that when people start digging, and as we're doing here, the obvious question is, well, who really did this, right? I mean, Bezos wants to know who hacked his text messages. And that's a reasonable question. But, you know, when he mentions when he tries to figure out who it is, and he's pointing to the Saudis without any kind of evidence, that's just bizarre. I mean, Saudi Arabia is not considered a major player in signals intelligence. They're not the Israelis or the French or the Australians even, who are all major players. Certainly not the U.S. So without saying why he thinks that, it doesn't make much sense. Certainly, it is obvious that that AMI, that owns the National Enquirer, does not want to know. It does not want it to come out how they obtained this information. And it could be something as innocuous, or I should say inane, as the hacking of the royals' phone messages in England that brought down members of a Murdoch-owned newspaper over there. And it turned out that tried to hack in to people's phone messages, and they typed passwords like 12345, and they worked. So it could be something that banal. Who knows?
Ted Rall, there are media reports right now that the immunity that was granted to David Pecker for his testimony in the Mueller probe might be rescinded because of AMI's conduct with Jeff Bezos. According to Jeff Bezos' own blog post, Pecker and the AMI were insisting that what they wanted, the thing that they were demanding from Bezos in exchange for not releasing even more graphic selfies that Bezos apparently took of himself, was, quote, a public mutually agreed upon acknowledgement from the Bezos parties released through a mutually agreeable news outlet affirming that they have no knowledge or basis for suggesting that AMI's coverage was politically motivated or influenced by political forces, and an agreement that they will cease referring to such a possibility, close quote. Ted Rall, can you comment on this?
I mean, you know, look, I don't work for American Media. I'm not one of their attorneys. So we're just speculating here. But I suspect that any involvement with any sort of hacking, whether it's receiving signals intercepts, if Jeff Bezos turns out to be correct, or something as inane as I described earlier, just simple hacking, is illegal. It violates federal law. And AMI is already in a consent agreement with the New York State Attorney General's office in that phase of the Mueller the catch and kill program that we referred to earlier. So they're supposed to be good little schoolboys. They're not supposed to, under the terms of that agreement, they're not supposed to break any laws at all. They're supposed to drive under 55. So there could be criminal exposure, and that could be a violation of the consent agreement. And so that could be a problem for AMI. We're left wondering who really did the hacking. You know, I have some sympathy for Bezos here, because when something like this happens to you and your information suddenly goes public, I'm not partial to taking pictures of my bits and putting them in the cloud, but I'm thinking of my situation at the LA Times, where my internal affairs complaint to the LAPD suddenly wound up, even though they're confidential government files, in the hands of the publisher of the LA Times at the time, who was a political ally of the LAPD. You know, I was wondering, you tend to speculate, and your mind goes to wild places, and you flail, and you think, well, you know, where did this go? I mean, I mistakenly thought it was the LAPD union, which it later turned out not to be. So I suspect Bezos's investigators and he are going to that place. It was probably unwise. It's never good to get ahead of any story. If he had been talking to perhaps experienced journalists at the Washington Post, they would have said, don't publish anything more than you actually know. But that's not what he did here.
This is an ever-growing story. We're going to continue to watch it to see what the political implications are as it unfolds. But we're out of time for that today. We were joined from New York by Ted Rall, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rall.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou, in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. A diplomatic row between France and Italy deepened yesterday as France recalled its ambassador to Italy after populist Italian Deputy Prime Minister Luigi Di Maio met with yellow vest leaders in central Paris. The media is calling the development the worst crisis between the two countries since the end of the Second World War. Italy has not been shy about criticizing French President Emmanuel Macron on issues ranging from immigration and trade to the yellow vests. We're joined by Gilbert Mercier. He's the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post and the author of The Orwellian Empire. Always good to have you, Gilbert.
Thank you for having me again, John.
Gilbert, I have to say I'm of two minds of this situation. First of all, it is highly unusual for a senior political figure in one country to insert himself in the internal affairs of another country. This is something that diplomats complain about formally all the time. But the Italian deputy prime minister doesn't seem to care. In fact, it looks as though his point was to offend President Macron. What do you make of this this situation? And how bad is this going to get before it gets any better?
Well, you know, I mean, all that has to be put, of course, in the context of the upcoming European election in May. But, you know, what I want to say here is there's a lot of stuff in the background of this that have nothing to do with the Gilets Jaunes. As you said, what triggered the diplomatic incident between France and Italy was that visit to some Gilets Jaunes in France. None of the key Gilets Jaunes, I mean, he didn't meet the like of Eric Drouet, William Nichols, or Priscilla Ludovsky. He met minor people. And Di Maio is part of the Five Star Movement, okay, which is part of the coalition government with the Northern League of Matteo Salvini, and is really you said it's a populist movement, but it's not a populist with the same connotation than Salvini. It's actually more like an anti-establishment movement, and in that regard, it's really more like the little bit like the France Insoumise in France. Now, you're probably not aware of that, but Luigi Di Maio wrote an open letter to Le Monde today, and it was published. And he kind of explained, you know, what he had in mind. And in his mind, from that letter, the thematic of the Gilets Jaunes, which is a anti-system and anti-political and really at heart an anti-capitalist movement, he feels like the revendication of the Gilets Jaunes goes way beyond the artificial cleavage, if you wish, of left and right. You know, and it's by putting, you know, the need of the citizen first, just like, in a sense, the five-star movement. So it's not a Di Maio feel, and he expressed in that open letter in Le Monde, that we are in a post-ideological era, if you wish. He said, and I'm translating, of course, that in his mind, the future of European politics is not within current parties, either from the right or the left. And it's very interesting, you know, this perspective. But, you know, Di Maio also said he was trying to patch things up a bit with Macron, at least the French people, that the Italian have always looked up to French people and France as a reference point in social struggle. And he also added that the political differences between France and Italy government should not affect the historical friendship between the two nations and its people. And I'm quoting again. I'm translating, but it's a quote. And you're right, it has not happened since World War II, except perhaps on football field, like people probably remember football known as soccer in the U.S. when Zinedine Zidane, the great French player, headbutt an Italian player during the final of the World Cup in 2006. But, you know, that's kind of a bit of a joke. But the thing is, okay, there's a deeper background here. And the deeper background is we have to consider right now the EU. Very soon it's going to be the European election. And the EU is under a lot of stress. There's also, of course, the Brexit factor. There's the rise of Eurosceptic, the far right, which are, you know, quite more or less neo-fascist in disguise. And let's not forget one thing, is the fact that this rift between France and Italy is very bad as another stress factor on the EU, because France and Italy were two of the founding members of the EU by the Treaty of Rome in 1957. This rift here is yet another sign that the EU is under a lot of stress, and this is not helpful. You know, now, Di Maio, and there's also an issue, of course, and this is the deeper issue. Di Maio has been very critical about the France foreign policy, and that's not of yesterday. He labeled French foreign policy neo-colonialist, and he's right, and especially in Africa. Let's not forget that in Libya, the Sarkozy administration in 2011 played a big role. As a matter of fact, they were sort of one of the instigators, of course, with the American, in the toppling of Gaddafi. You know, and now Macron, Africa's military project, is the so-called G5 Sahel. G5 Sahel is a nice little military operation that include Burkina Faso, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, and Chad. And yesterday, French jet fighters were bombing Chad. Of course, it's always following the same pretext, which is to fight jihadists. You know, kind of like the Syrian model, or whatever. But G5 Sahel is in reality, it's supposed to be free of foreign influence, but in reality, it's under the supervision of the French military. There's roughly 4,500 French troops in this operation, half of that foreign legion, half of that special forces. You know, and it's a nice little, it's of course a nice little way to display French military hardware. Let's not forget that the military industry, military industrial complex in France is very, very strong. They love to sell weapons.
Tell me, with relations as bad as they are between France and Italy right now, because of this one specific issue, what's the solution? It seems that the Italians, at least the coalition government in Rome, really does not like President Macron. It seems to be personal. And I wonder if it's because they feel that there's a double standard within the European Union, that France is treated one way and Italy is treated another. The EU leadership is much tougher with Italy on economic questions, on things like budget deficits, than they are on Macron and the French. So how does this resolve itself? We have about a minute and a half.
It's very simple, John. It's there's the rich EU member, which is Germany mainly, and France and the Netherlands and Belgium, and there's the poor EU member, which is Greece, the country of the south, Italy, Spain, and Portugal to some extent. But the big issue right now, in terms of foreign policy, and if Europe is going to stick together, is the Venezuela issue. As you know, Italy and Greece were the only two countries not to side with the U.S. administration-sponsored coup to topple legitimately elected Maduro. Besides Italy and Greece, all other EU members, plus the U.K., as nation, have aligned with Washington and recognized Juan Guaido. Now, the issue of the EU, and I mentioned that in a New York Post article not that long ago, is really NATO. What EU countries should do is become sovereign vis-a-vis Washington, sovereign vis-a-vis the empire. That's what they should do. Otherwise, they will never see the light of day.
I think you're exactly right. We're going to have to leave it there, Gilbert. We're out of time. We were joined by Gilbert Mercier. He is the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post and the author of The Orwellian Empire. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Freshman Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a Democrat from New York, and Senator Ed Markey, a Democrat from Massachusetts, yesterday sponsored a massive bill that they are calling the Green New Deal. It's a policy package that would reshape the entire U.S. economy and, in the end, eliminate all carbon emissions. In doing so, it aims to boost the economy and create millions of jobs. We're joined from Baltimore by Dr. Margaret Flowers. She's a medical doctor and the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. You can find their work at www.popularresistance.org. Welcome back, Margaret.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Margaret, of course, there's no chance that this is going to become law in its current form. It's just been sponsored in the House. It hasn't been sponsored in the Senate, but it sure is an interesting idea. And I want to get your comments on what it means. And the reason why this is so interesting to me is that it was immediately attacked by the Wall Street Journal and Fox News. And that tells me that they're a little bit afraid of its contents.
Well, I mean, the Green New Deal is definitely an idea that we need right now. We are facing, you know, severe climate catastrophe if we don't take really significant action in the next decade to reduce our, you know, carbon emissions, our greenhouse gas emissions down to net zero. I wish I could be as enthusiastic about the Green New Deal resolution that was put forth, but it's actually really more of a framework that kind of puts forward some good ideas, but doesn't have any actual specifics in it. So I think the president of the Bipartisan Policy Center described it best, that it's a mirror through which anybody can see what they want to see. But this is both, you know, it's good that this idea is out there and being discussed, but we have a lot of work to do to actually fill in that framework and make it happen.
One of the things that's fascinating to me about this, and I want to get your comments, is that it purports to have as a goal the eventual doing away with air travel, for example, as we know it. How would that work?
So I've read this. It's actually just a 14-page resolution, so I encourage people to read it. I've read it, you know, several times now, and I don't see those kinds of specifics. I mean, you know, I think that we need to significantly rethink our transportation globally, and a lot of that is moving to electrified rapid transportation, which would significantly reduce the need for air travel. But of course, that electric transportation needs to be fueled by, you know, really renewable energy resources. And that's one thing that the Green New Deal is completely vague about. It doesn't specify what they consider to be renewable energy resources. And there's a lot of debate within the, you know, the climate justice movement about which resources are truly clean and which aren't.
NPR said this morning, Margaret, that this Green New Deal doesn't even mention some of the usual ideas for addressing climate change, things like a carbon tax or cap and trade program that we've been talking about for the last decade or so. Instead, it calls for lots of spending, new spending, to create, among other things, infrastructure and transport that don't rely on fossil fuels. We need an infrastructure bill in this country right now. We need a transport bill in this country right now. And it seems to me that there's no downside to developing a green alternative to what to the system that we have in place now. It would make political sense for Donald Trump to embrace some of these ideas. I'm asking you here to prognosticate, I suppose. Is there any room for compromise with the Republicans based on what you've seen in the 14-page outline? Is there anything that, with the Wall Street Journal and Fox News aside, might be appealing to Republicans and could turn part of this plan into law?
I mean, I think that this should appeal to anybody who understands the severity of the crisis that we're facing and the need for action. I mean, if you look at the infrastructure in the United States is deteriorating. It's been given, you know, failing grades. If we look at our other wealthy countries around the world, they're so far superior to us in terms of their transportation sectors. Many countries that have publicly owned transportation sectors that are very efficient and very heavily used. You know, it just, all of this really makes sense when you look at what we need to do to really address this crisis and the fact that if we don't do it, you know, it's already costing us hundreds of billions of dollars a year to deal with the drought, the fires, the superstorms and hurricanes, but the health impacts, people having to migrate, you know, these are all things that are here now. They're only going to get worse unless we do something about it.
I was interested in something that came out today from the Council on Foreign Relations. I want to read you something from an NPR story. It says, these days, transportation accounts for the largest share of greenhouse gas emissions. Green New Deal backers say they want more high-speed trains to make air travel less necessary and more electric cars and charging stations. But experts warn that changing the existing fleet of cars in the U.S. would be an extraordinary effort. Quote, there are 350 million liquid fuel cars on the road today in the United States, and most Americans don't buy a new car except every decade, unquote, says Amy Myers Jaffe, director of the Program on Energy Security and Climate Change at the Council on Foreign Relations. I would say, so what? If it's going to take 10 years to transition, let's say, 50% of our vehicles from liquid fuel to electricity, people are going to buy a new car in 10 years anyway. I mean, in 10 years, we're all going to be 10 years older. We might as well have that many cars off the road, that many gas-powered cars off the road than not. So what's the downside to adopting some of these goals? Is there any downside?
There is no downside. And in fact, the transition to electric vehicles is already occurring in the United States and to a much greater degree in other countries around the world where they have a specific goal of moving to those quickly. We need to start doing this now, recognizing that the sooner we act, the faster we can get, you know, where we need to go. So I think a combination of electric vehicles, but I think we can have the biggest impact by providing affordable, high quality, public transportation. And that's really what we need to do. We need to really rethink the whole idea of how we get ourselves around to make it one that uses much fewer resources and is much more energy efficient.
What can Americans do today, right now, to sort of push the country into the right direction? Is there anything that can be done without an act of Congress? Is there anything that can be done without the appropriation of millions or billions of dollars? How can we get this thing started now?
Well, I think that, you know, people are doing things all around the country. And, you know, there's people who do things at the individual level when they're able to do that. But we recognize that individual efforts are not going to solve this crisis when these are really bigger picture problems. So I think that people should educate themselves about what the climate crisis is and what we need to do to resolve it. The Green Party has for a long time had a Green New Deal in its platform on the website. And I think that's an excellent piece for people to look at because it's very specific about what needs to be done. And then people can push in their local communities and in their states for a faster transition to clean renewable sources of energy, for building efficiency, for restoration of wetlands, moving to agriculture that actually sequesters carbon, moving to a more localized economy. There's lots of things that we can be doing in our communities to put in place some of the things that should be in this Green New Deal. And then hopefully that, as that, you know, grows and that awareness grows, more of that will be done.
Kimberly Strassel, who is a columnist for The Wall Street Journal, tweeted yesterday, it's kind of an offensive tweet. It says, "By the end of the Green New Deal resolution and accompanying fact sheet, I was laughing so hard I nearly cried. If a bunch of GOPers plotted to forge a fake Democratic bill showing how bonkers the party is, they could not have done a better job. It is beautiful. Hashtag Green New Deal." That's just mean-spirited. It's not substantive, so let's push it aside. But one of the points that she makes later is that in order to live up to the proposal's promise of 100% renewable energy, a space as big as the entire state of California would have to be dedicated solely for the facilities, wind turbines, and solar panels. Is that true?
No. And, you know, it just shows how out of touch she is with the reality. You know, there are countries that have already moved closer to 100% renewable energy resources. And you can do it in a very decentralized way, which is actually the preferred way, because we'd like to see a transition to a clean energy economy that actually benefits more people, not just further, you know, enriches those few countries at the top. And so doing rooftop solar on, you know, houses and all kinds of larger buildings is one way. Farmers are adding windmills to their farms. We can do tidal. We can do offshore wind. There's lots of ways that we can produce energy using the space that we have.
We've got 60 seconds left. Margaret, talk a little bit about the politics involved here. Ed Markey is a highly respected senator in the Senate, but he's a member of the minority party. The Republicans control the Senate. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is also wildly popular and suddenly has found herself in a position of authority. What are the politics involved here? Does this thing or a version of a Green New Deal have any shot in this Republican Senate? Or do we have to wait until the Democrats retake the Senate?
I think we have to also recognize that Democrats are not friends to this, even though, you know, Senator Markey and Congresswoman, you know, Ocasio-Cortez have put this forward. Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, has, you know, refused to create a Green New Deal committee. She created this select committee on climate change, but she took away all of its power to subpoena witnesses or draft legislation. The Green New Deal was supposed to have specific language, at least in the fact sheet, about moving off of nuclear power, and that was quickly curtailed, and that has been removed from the fact sheet. So these big industries that are profiting from the current system still have a lot of power. And I say it's more important what we as people do to change the political culture than actually who's in power.
That was the voice of Dr. Margaret Flowers, who joined us from Baltimore. She is a medical doctor and the co-coordinator of Popular Resistance. Check out their work at www.popularresistance.org. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
In the midst of the political turmoil in Washington and the changes in trade policy worldwide, more and more American farmers are facing bankruptcy. We're joined from Madison, Wisconsin by Kathy Schmidt. She's Bureau Director, Farm and Agribusiness Services, and Frank Fryer, Economic Specialist, Financial Consulting and Farm Succession Planning, both at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Kathy, let's start with you. With the economy as strong as it purportedly is, and even with tariffs in place that are supposed to be protecting some American farmers, we're seeing more and more farm bankruptcies. In fact, we're seeing the highest number of farm bankruptcies that we've seen in the last 11 years. Why is that?
Well, the farm economy hasn't been very good in Wisconsin, and actually for much of the nation for almost 4 years running now. And so though farmers are used to having a cycle in farming of ups and downs, this one is particularly long.
Frank, is this different? Is the problem different for small farmers, family farmers, than it is for larger corporate farmers?
Well, I think it depends on how you evaluate it. I think we see some large farms having financial issues also. We see middle-sized farms. So I think it's affecting farms across the board. The one difference between the farm sizes is family living. If it costs a family $50,000 a year to live, which is what Iowa reports from doing some research in Minnesota, that $50,000 mark, and you have 50 cows and you make $1,000 a cow profit, that would be considered very good profit per cow. That just covers the family living. It doesn't cover any capital replacement, doesn't cover any principal payment. So if you're milking 1,000 cows and you have $1,000 of profit per cow, you can pay some of those expenses.
So it's an issue of scale here. Kathy, we're looking at a piece in Politico that ran just day before yesterday saying that average farm income has fallen to a 15-year low under President Trump, and in some areas of the country, including Wisconsin and Minnesota, farm bankruptcies are soaring. What would it take to turn this situation around? How can farms be saved in this economy?
Well, I think farmers have been sharpening their pencils and doing the best that they can to reduce their cost of production and be able to stay in business. But we have, at least in dairy, quite a surplus of product. And so until that evens out, until the exports pick up again, until we can ship soybeans across the ocean, you know, to China, I think they're going to continue to struggle for a while. Frank, do you want to add to that?
It varies by farm. Here's a young farmer, and we see too much of this, and they're calling us, asking for help. They're getting $18 a hundredweight for their milk. Their neighbors may be getting 14 or 15, but because this young couple started in around 2014, they missed the high price. They have too much debt. It's costing them almost $30 a hundredweight to produce milk, and they're getting 18. That's the problem. And the same thing for the crop people. They're getting maybe 260, 270, 280, depends on what the bushel of corn is bringing today, but it's costing them $3 a bushel to produce it.
Kathy, this actually sounds more complicated than what the media is leading us to believe. This isn't just, correct me if I'm wrong here, this isn't just a result of the administration's economic policies right now. This isn't a result of what are probably going to be temporary or relatively temporary tariffs. This sounds like a much broader problem of farm policy coupled with a farm economy that's just simply not healthy right now. Is that right?
Yeah, it's much more complicated than the tariffs. And these issues started happening before the tariffs were imposed. So, you know, if you look at the dairy situation, which Wisconsin is heavy into the dairy situation, we have farmers who know how to produce really well. And that's true for the grain farmers also, you know, the bushels per acre they get is substantially more than what they had 20 or 30 years ago. The same with dairy. The genetics that they're able to use, the feed they're able to put into the animals, all of those things, the housing is better, the cows are more comfortable, they milk more. And so you have every cow making more. And then a period where prices were pretty good, and so a lot of farmers increased their herd numbers, which was easy to do because you could use same-sex semen and get a lot of heifers in your pipeline without having to purchase them. On top of all of that, we had, you know, milk shipping across into Canada, out to China, and, you know, many other places. Just so many factors that fed into where we're at now, which is we have too much product sitting in the United States. And until that evens out and the market evens things out, which unfortunately is going to mean we're going to lose a number of dairy farmers, this is going to continue to be the situation that we have.
Frank, tell me how cyclical this kind of thing is. If this is the worst situation in the last 15 years for farmers, and it crosses over different areas of specialization, whether it's dairy or soybean or cattle or whatever, how do farmers pull themselves out of it? Is that going to require some sort of government intervention?
That's the ultimate question. I wish I was smart enough to answer it. I think part of it is, Kathy explained it very well, we got the best farmers we've ever had living today, producing more product than they've ever produced. I think what we got to do, we got to find a way, whether it's corn or beans or milk or beef or pork, to add more products so that consumers are buying more of the milk. Maybe it's not milk. Maybe it's some new product that's manufactured from milk. But we've got to find a way to absorb the surplus we have in the production end.
Kathy, we've got about 2.5 minutes left. Tell me, who is it that farmers would turn to in a situation like this? Would it be the Department of Agriculture? Would it be another organization inside the administration? Or would it be their elected officials, members of Congress, for example, who sit on the agriculture committee? How do they get out of this with government assistance?
Well, one of the things they can do is contact their local farm service agency because there are some new price protections that have been placed into play that will help a little bit. That's a short-term solution. Long-term, there are some states like Wisconsin that have services like our Wisconsin Farm Center where we have staff that can go sit down at the kitchen table with the farmer, help them look at their financial situation, try and see what options are available for restructuring debt in some way, and give them the information they need to make choices about how they're going to move forward. We have all those kinds of services available. There's also in 41 states a farm mediation and arbitration program. So that allows farmers to be able to invite folks that they owe money to, which could be their bank or it might be their local mill or their veterinarians or whatever, to sit down and talk about what are some solutions, can we come to an agreement on how to resolve the debt that I have in a way that I can still do business with y'all. So that's a program that's available almost across the nation. And then we offer some additional resources here because our farm center has been well supported by state government since 1984. So we have a counseling voucher program that farmers can tap if they're feeling really stressed and they want to have some additional help in that area, then we can supply them with vouchers so they're not worrying about how much is this going to cost me. So those kinds of services can help farmers think through, you know, where they're going to go and how they're going to move forward in their farming situation.
Complicated problem. It's good to know that farmers have different places where they can go for help, whether it's at the state level or at the federal level. This is something I think most Americans just simply aren't focused on. It's very important, and it has to be addressed before it gets out of hand. We will leave it there. We were happy to be joined from Madison, Wisconsin by Kathy Schmidt. She's Bureau Director, Farm and Agribusiness Services, and by Frank Fryer, Economic Specialist, Financial Consulting and Farm Succession Planning, both at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his site Left Eye on the News, which you can find at lefti.blogspot.com, where you can find all the worst headlines that we don't have time to get to today. Steve also tweets at Left Eye Blog. And we're joined here in the studio by Nicole Russell. She's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks so much.
Delighted to join you.
Steve, let's start with a hard right-wing editorial in the Wall Street Journal, which somehow finds itself in deep fear of socialism.
Yeah, for those of us on the left, this was the laugh out loud headline of the week. Who's afraid of socialism? The new democratic agenda sure looks like government control over the means of production.
I mean, this has no basis in reality, Steve.
No, it does not. I mean, it sort of takes up from on the Trumpian thing about this country will never be socialist. But this article is even more deranged than Trump. I mean, it talks about, just to be a little specific about the editorial, which probably doesn't
merit that, but here we go.
I mean, they talk about the Green New Deal, which has a plan to replace all cars with electric cars. Who's going to make these cars? GM and Tesla and Ford, not the government.
You mean they're still going to make profits, which is how capitalism works?
Exactly.
You know, the Green New Deal actually has not been endorsed by Nancy Pelosi. She's not agreed to allow this thing to be debated in committee or to come to the floor for a vote. It's just been proposed. It's just been sponsored by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey. It's not to say that it's the Democratic agenda. It's not the Democratic agenda.
She even
agenda.
Snorted over it derisively,
yes,
and called it the green whatever or
yes,
something like that. I
yes.
mean, yeah.
Yeah, she mocked it. She not only didn't endorse it, she mocked it.
But yeah, I mean, the idea of like free education, which is not even being proposed, but is on, you know, like Bernie's kind of like must have list, is, again, has nothing to do with the means of production. Companies are still very much in control of the means of production in this country.
Yeah, for sure.
Let's move on to Venezuela, Steve. There's a lot here.
Yeah, the big story of the week continues to be Venezuela. And just as it was last week, the big headline story or the media story continues to be the total whiteout of the opposite of the support for the government in the media. So here's a typical headline from the New York Times from right after the big demonstrations that happened last Saturday. Venezuelans opposed to Maduro pour into streets for day of protests. Well, that headline is true. It's just not the whole truth, because there were equally sized rallies or comparably sized rallies in support of the government. And if you read this article, the Chavista rally, this pro-government rally, does make it into the article in the 32nd paragraph. You have to be very patient in reading this article if you ever want to find out that there were actually people in the streets supporting the government.
I mean, that's been the case the whole time, Steve. All of these headlines that say Venezuelans opposed to Maduro pour into the streets for day of protest could easily say the exact opposite, because the exact opposite is true, or could say both truths, which is Venezuelans opposed to Maduro and Venezuelans in support of Maduro and the Bolivarian Revolution, pour into the streets for days of protest. This has happened ever since the coup. It's been on both sides, but we've only seen one, unless you're on Twitter.
My favorite part of this story, there was a picture, and the picture had the following caption: thousands attended what appeared to be a counter rally to Mr. Guaido's to show their support for Mr. Maduro. Now, why did that amuse me? Because the picture has a huge sign reading "Yankee, go home." But they weren't sure this was a picture of a rally, you know, in support of Mr. Maduro.
Not sure if this what this is, but it appears like it might be a counter rally. The signs aren't pointing us in the right direction here.
And by the way, it's not that this information wasn't available even to, you know, to people who read Venezuela analysis or left wing or left kind of sources. I actually watched on Fox News a reporter who was in Caracas, and he talked about how there were dueling protests in Venezuela, and he talked about how there were tens of thousands on both sides. So it certainly was possible for an honest reporter to be there and to report honestly about, you know, the large protests on both sides. But that didn't apply to the New York Times, and also didn't apply to the Washington Post.
It's a shocker, it's Fox News, but at least somebody's doing honest reporting for a moment.
Yeah, for sure. Now, here's another Venezuela analysis, Venezuela headline. This one's from the New York Times, which really annoyed me. Venezuela's crisis spreads beyond its borders. The citizens of Venezuela have become pawns in a global power game. Well, this is complete nonsense. What's happening in Venezuela is a struggle between the U.S. government, U.S. imperialism, and the people of Venezuela and the Maduro government. The New York Times wants to bring in Russia, and China and Turkey, they threw into the mix here, just to enlist the democratic, Russophobia into their cause. There is no sense in which what's happening in Venezuela is part of a global power game. This is strictly the U.S. versus the people of Venezuela. Period.
Right. And if anything, Trump himself has brought other kind of Latin American allies into this to try to put pressure on Venezuela. For example, we keep hearing about how Venezuelan citizens have been streaming out of Venezuela to other places when the same thing has actually been happening in Colombia in a bigger number. 6 million Colombians have, because of the right-wing government and other issues, come into Venezuela and been welcomed with open arms. So if anything, the crisis may have spread beyond its borders, but it's been supported, the coup has been supported by right-wing governments in the Lima Group nearby, with the U.S., really pushing this on the Lima Group and pushing this on governments nearby.
The most bizarre claim in this article, which amused me in a way, is the New York Times claims that only, quote, the army and diehard leftists are still standing with Maduro. So it seems that was an editorial. So what I say is, it seems like the people writing the editorials are only reading the New York Times, because if they were reading other news, they'd actually know that there were hundreds of thousands of people standing with the government, not just the army and diehard leftists, quote unquote.
If diehard leftists means half the nation, then okay, I guess that's it.
That'd be nice. Well, and of course, and now we get to the even more bizarre and more scary, really. And this was an interview. This is on Fox Business. An interview Mike Pompeo did, and the headline reads, "Cuban, Hezbollah, and Iranian cells drawn to embattled Venezuela." And this is Pompeo pushing the idea that Hezbollah has active cells in Venezuela. And then this line really got me. "The Cubans invaded Venezuela. The Cubans have been controlling the security apparatus, protecting Maduro, and destroying the way of life for the Venezuelan people for an awfully long time." Well, here's the facts. The Cubans have actually, one of the main things they've done in Venezuela is provide medical care. And the Cubans have, through something called Operation Miracle, actually restored the sight of more than a million Venezuelans. So that's what Cuba had. They haven't been destroying the way of life for the Venezuelan people. This is just such an offensive concept over and above this idea that, Hezbollah has got secret cells and doing God knows what. Mike Pompeo never says, because, of course, this is just made up out of whole cloth. It's just bizarre.
Right. Cuba was one of the few governments that was actually doing business with Venezuela during the sanctions, too, right? This is not infiltration. This is just like reasonable diplomacy.
Right. And by the way, the use of Iranian in the headline, the Hezbollah and Iranian cells, there is absolutely nothing in this article or what Pompeo said that has anything to do with Iran other than the claim that, that Hezbollah is supported by Iran. But the headline claim, you'd think that there's Iranian troops or something in Venezuela, just like there are, in fact, in Syria. But that's not what he's even alleging. It's just a false headline completely.
Let's go to the next one then. Boy, there's so much going on with Venezuela. Do you want to continue on with Venezuela?
Let's just do one or two more. This one, let's skip to the following ones. And these are the things that I call fake news by omission. These are stories which have not been in the Washington Post or the New York Times. The first one's from Press TV, which is the Iranian outlet. UN rejects Venezuela's Guaido, will only cooperate with recognized government of Maduro. Now, that's an important story. The UN still is, the UN's secretariat recognizes Maduro as the legitimate government of Venezuela. That information has not appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, or anything. I found an article in Reuters which referenced that. Nowhere else could I find a reference to that. And the other story, which this one comes from The Independent in the UK, Venezuela crisis. Former UN rapporteur, a guy named Alfred Dezaeus, says U.S. sanctions are killing citizens. Well, that's rather an important story. Again, you can search the New York Times or the Washington Post or AP for the name Alfred Dezaeus, or for this entire story, totally white it out.
Yeah, Alfred Azayas has actually been on this show. He's very well-renowned UN rapporteur. He, you know, used to make these reports for the UN, but you're right, I haven't seen him on mainstream media, and I suspect it's because he is telling the truth in ways people don't want.
We are out of time, Steve, so we're going to have to end it there. We were joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Steve Patt. Steve's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his site Left Eye on the News that you can find at lefti.blogspot.com. And you can also find all the worst headlines that we didn't have a chance to get to. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog. And we were joined here in the studio by Nicole Russell. She's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.